Welcome to F1 Debrief episode 100, Ben-Hur Without the Horses. Coming up on this debrief special, we talk weather, penalties and honesty. We are joined once again by Joe Saywood from GrandPrix.com, who has woken very early to talk to us from Malaysia. Hi, Joe. What's it like over there?
It's dark, actually. It's dark, and they've got those strange birds out in the jungle squawking, and there are those Muslim chaps singing their songs as they do at very strange hours in the morning. So it's all very active here, actually.
That's a hell of a wake-up call.
It sort of happens when we go to the Muslim countries. You know, they have these the sort of, I would say, dawn choruses, but you know, the call to prayer, and it sort of pervades your consciousness. Even if you're in a nice air conditioned hotel, you can still hear the sort of chanting that goes on. So you tend to be up early anyway. Not to mention the fact, of course, we all live in this twilight zone of jet lag. So it doesn't really matter what time of day it is, really.
You mentioned on your blog, it must have been yesterday, if I haven't lost track of time already. You're near a golf course.
Yesterday is a negotiable object, isn't it? You know,
it could be anytime.
When does it begin and end? Because today, you know, different part of the world, different time zone. So, yes, I mean, I have no idea when it was. It was either today or yesterday.
But you're in the middle of nowhere, but you're near a golf course.
I am in the middle of nowhere on a self-contained sort of resorty thing. I've stayed here every year. Since the very start of the Grand Prix, and it's, you know, it's sort of half an hour away from the track, and it's got everything you need, and you don't have to think, you don't have to fight your way through the markets or the traffic or anything. It's just generally quite easy. But you know, if you're looking for sort of wild nights out, it's a bit thin on the ground. But then again, KLM park all their stewardesses here, so I have known one or two fairly raucous evenings gone on here. So.
One of the big topics of conversation over here is what the weather is going to be like and whether it's going to rain. Have you seen much rain? Does it get really dark? What's it going to be like for the race?
Well, there was a spectacular storm yesterday afternoon, actually about the same time as they were having their press conference. And, you know, this was like sort of monsoon, major league monsoon, tropical storm kind of rain. And it lasted about half an hour or so, and it can happen any time, but generally speaking, there's a sort of pattern out here in the tropics. You know, nice sunny mornings, and gradually the humidity builds up, and then about 4 in the afternoon it sort of lets rip. So the fact that the race is going to be starting, I think, at 5 means that we'll either be in the middle of a rainstorm or yeah, it'll just have happened. So it could be quite entertaining on Sunday, but it tends to follow the same sort of pattern.
There was a lot of complaints going into Australia about the fact that the race was running a bit later, and it was going to be an evening race. And there was at the end of the Grand Prix, some of the drivers were complaining about the sun setting in their eyes. As I think you mentioned, you were one of the first people to bring it up. What's your feeling of going into this one? And is it going to be worse?
People always complain about anything that's new. It's one of the things about the human being likes to complain. And in fact, I think in Melbourne, the only thing that was bad about it, I think from a public point of view, it was much better. All the general opinion among the Australians, they did some vox pops in the paper to see what people thought. And, you know, it was sort of 80% thought it was a good idea. And I thought it was a pretty good idea, actually. The only downside of it was that the sun was quite low for a couple of, you know, the last sort of 10 minutes of the race. The sun was very low in the sky. And, you know, I can see why, you know, if you're driving, you go around a corner and the sun's in your eyes. I don't think it was unmanageable. I think it's just another kind of, you know, it's what's the difference between that and driving in a rainstorm? You know, it's hard to do. You have to look at it as being part of the show. I think that, you know, Formula One must remember that it is actually needs to cater to an audience. Now, this is something that is often forgotten, particularly by stewards and team owners. You know, let's declare the result again 4 days later. And this sort of stuff. And it's not smart. And it's not, you know, you can say, yes, there's new evidence and this and that and blah, blah, blah. But the fact is, fundamentally, it's an entertainment. And when people go home, they want to know what they've seen is what they've seen. You know, you don't have cricket matches where they come back a week later and say, well, actually, India didn't win. because this man, you know, had a bit of, who knows, we know, whatever the story is, that we found a bit of film that showed that he had a little bit of grease on his trousers, so he rubbed the ball and there made it spin more, and therefore blah blah blah.
Absolutely, yep.
You know, you've got to draw a line under it somewhere. And you know, and the other thing about the Australian, we haven't even had the diffuser thing yet, so you know, theoretically speaking, we can throw out the first two as well as throwing out the third one, you know.
Which puts Alonso as the race winner.
No, I think Trulli is probably the race winner. But I mean, you know, let's face it, that's ludicrous too, because I'm amazed about Toyota in Australia. You know, they were found to be running an illegal rear wing in practice, and they were just sent to the back of the grid, which to me was shocking. You know, if you're found to be running an illegal rear wing, you know, they said it was a production error. Well, I mean, you know, Toyota's famous for producing bad cars and getting things wrong in production processes, aren't they? I mean, it's just a load of...
Sure.
I don't, well, whatever.
Yes.
But, you know, the fact of the matter is that in Formula One, if your rear wing is like jelly, it's generally probably because it was meant to be. And I just... find it rather strange that there is inconsistency going on in the way that things are done. It's I don't know. I don't really understand it. All I know is that Formula One is fundamentally, while being a terrific and wonderful sport, it doesn't exist unless people watch it. And if people are given strange things happening all the time, they tend to throw their hands up in the air and say, I really don't need this, you know, because I've got better things to do on a Sunday afternoon. Mm. So, you know, we have to remember that we are, in fact, also a form of entertainment. And, you know, the people, grown men slitting each other's throats in public is really not that exciting.
Do you think, without really going into the detail, because that would just take forever, but regarding the press... and the public relations unmitigated failure on Formula One's behalf yesterday. Do you think we've seen the end of it now? Is it over? And have they drawn a line under that McLaren case, or is there going to be more to come?
I haven't got the faintest idea. I think that it would be very wise, not that wisdom comes into it very much, that you know you get to the end of something and you finish it and you say, this is done and dusted and let's get on with it. You know, McLaren... whatever happened, whether it was deliberately telling lies, whether it was not telling the whole truth, whether it was the fact that they thought that the stewards already knew, whatever it was, you know, frankly, who cares? You know, the bottom line of it is, let's just get on with it and do it. We did. None of us saw the incident with Trulli anyway. I mean, you know, that the TV cameras are there to presumably catch as much as possible, and nobody actually saw what was going on, so it's very hard to know what was going on. Later on, you can have all these radio things, but, you know, why... the stewards took forever to make that decision.
Yes, they did. Yep.
On Sunday night already, so why on earth weren't they listening to the radio transcripts anyway?
That's a very good point.
I don't understand why all these things... And, you know, Charlie Whiting knew about it, I'm sure, because they were talking to him on the radio. You can hear that from the FIA's thing. You know, there's all kinds of questions as to why these things... You know, why wasn't this all done at the time? And I think it's really... I think it's very wrong, to sort of bring things back 3, 4, 5 days later. And it's a new phenomenon. It hasn't happened before. It happened for the first time in China... I think in a year and a half ago or something. But, you know, there is this sort of... in football, you have a referee, and if the referee screws up, the referee screws up.
Yeah.
And later on you say, well, we don't have to have that referee anymore. I mean, you know, if you go through... nobody ever does, but if you go through the records of some of these FIA stewards and some of the decisions they've made, you think, oh, my God, it's him again. You know, and obviously he's there because, you know, there are political reasons that they have to be there because... you know, they represent this country or that country. But, you know, it's like referees. If the referees make good decisions, fine. If they don't, they make, you know, they shouldn't be allowed back. But, you know, what we do have to have is we have to have consistency. And we are supposed to have that we've got this sort of steward's advisor, Alan Donnelly, who is Max Mosley's closest advisor, I suppose, and a former Labour MP, not an MP, European MP. You know, and he's a clever guy. And you know, let's get consistency. Let's not have these things come back again. And let's have a system whereby, you know, by a Monday morning we know what the result's going to be.
Sounds more than reasonable. Talking of ongoing debates, though, the Fuser row hasn't been resolved. The last time we spoke, obviously, it just been the appeal had just been raised. We now have a date for that. Again, we end up with a situation where the results are still yet to change. Do you think at the moment NASCAR has, a ruling that says the results are what the results are when the fans leave the gate and it never changes? Do you think Formula One needs to implement something along those lines?
Yeah, I do. I think it's, I mean, the diffuser row is an interesting one in as much as we have a new set of rules, and sometimes the rules are not negotiable, but you need to have a bit of push and shove to establish exactly what they mean. And this is what's happened with the diffuser. It should have been really, they should have been sorted out before it ever became a protesting issue. But it became a protesting issue because some teams, I think, if I'm being brutally frank about it, and not that I ever am, but if I was being brutally frank about the whole diffuser thing, I think an awful lot of the whinging and the protesting is because the teams who didn't do it need excuses to go to their sponsors and or bosses and say, we didn't do this. And not, you know, they need to have some sort of thing whereby they say, yes, but it's not fair, and da, 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 da. They've got to have something to argue with. You know, because if you are, for example, Flavio Briatore, and you're going to Paris to tell Mr. Carlos Ghosn at Renault, who brackets is a bit busy, you know, wiping out car factories and things, he really doesn't have much time for this, and he says, what the hell's going on? And you know, Flav can't say, well, we just screwed up, and the other blokes are cleverer than we are, because, you know, next thing you know, he'll be thrown in the Seine. I think there's a level of the complaining and the appealing is a sort of self-justification for the teams who didn't think of it. And you can bet your bottom dollar that every single one of them is doing putting these diffusers in the wind tunnel as we speak.
Absolutely.
And running them 24 hours a day to try and get up and catch up with the others. But you know, when they've done all that, they're going to have a nasty shock because they're going to find actually that the diffuser's not really the whole story. And the brawn has got lots of little bits, and you know, this is the way it is in Formula One. And you know, they're all rushing around putting their diffusers on, and they'll all be hoping that this will put them, leapfrog them ahead or up to the same level of brawn. They might find that it's not going to be quite that easy, but we'll see. I think that, you know, what I like about this season is we have new stories to tell. We have new teams. It's all a bit topsy-turvy. The Ferraris, basically, you know, they should open a plant for destroying rubber. You know,
they're not
those,
like...
Those cars are terrific at demolishing tyres.
How did that happen? Because last year they were too light and couldn't generate any heat into their tyres, and then suddenly this year it's completely turned around.
Well, it's probably something to do with the fact we've got completely different tyres, and you know, I really don't know is the answer. I mean, this is when you get into the art of why one tyre works and when another one doesn't, on which car, what car, whatever. More often than not, I think the engineers don't even understand, you know, because the tyres are very strange and magical things, and people who make them are wild-haired and wild-eyed, you know, with big cauldrons and sort of throwing in, you know, bits and pieces of dead pigeon and things. It's alchemy, you know. As to why it grips a bit of road and another one doesn't is utterly beyond me. And I've talked to some of these compounders and things, and they do all kinds of wacky things, like God knows what they put in these things, but you know, anything that works, really get the bit of grip, and sometimes they just don't understand why. They just accept it, that's fine.
We had a question raised, I think, today in the comments on our site, which I wouldn't mind putting to you, and just to see if you had any thoughts on it. I think this afternoon your time, 4 p.m. there's a press conference with Braun, Toyota, Williams, and I think McLaren. Presumably, hot topic is going to be diffusers. Is it coincidental that those are the teams that have been chosen, or is that the FIA basically playing games and trying to generate some headlines from that?
I don't think there's ever any coincidence involved in these things. I mean, no, I mean, to be quite honest, if you are sitting there and you're looking for ways to promote the sport and get it in the papers, you want to get the story. Now, whether you get the story is another matter, because the people sitting there might, as we saw yesterday, Lewis Hamilton was in the press conference yesterday afternoon, it was no comment, no comment, we'll talk about it later, and when it came to later, he ran away, which was a bit naughty. This is the way that the teams are. They are not necessarily very good at presenting themselves to the world, and the FIA, by putting the right people in the right places, trying to create stories, I think that's the way I look at it anyway, and I don't see any wrong with that. I mean, you know, it is a media business. Fundamentally, what drives the revenues is the media, and so you have to play to the media and what the media want. And teams that don't do that are not very clever. So I don't think there's any problem with who you pick for the press conference. It's better than having random things. I mean, what on earth would we want this afternoon if we had Force India and who knows, a man from Marshall Post 3, you know. What we want is what the story is, so I have no objection to that at all.
Are you expecting anything to come out of it, or do you think it's going to be, do you think they're going to completely shut up and not give us any more information?
Oh, you tend to get sort of interface envelope, wombat fish paste kind of comments, you know, which don't make any sense at all and are totally unquotable. But
what do you reckon McLaren still haven't protested this diffuser yet? They didn't really turn up. They turned up with new parts in Australia, and they're supposed to be flying out new parts to Malaysia. But still no identical diffuser. So how come they have yet to protest this?
Well, maybe they just actually agree that it's just clever engineering and that they should have thought of it.
Fair point.
That, to me, is the only logical conclusion you can reach. I just think that it's interesting because they're all big, the big manufacturer teams all missed it. And, well, apart from Toyota, I suppose they are fairly big, aren't they? But, you know, the others, Ferrari, BMW, and Renault, all sort of didn't get it. And actually, Toyota only got it because they recruited the right person, I think, from Honda. There is a certain level of team size where ingenuity still wins through. Sometimes the teams get so big, and, you know, it's more to do with rubber stamps on desks than actually sort of somebody walking into the chief designer's office and saying, you never guess what I dreamt up. You know, it's very much more sort of paper shoving around and committee meetings and all the rest of it. And so, you know, sometimes the smaller organizations are going to be better because the ingenuity and the sort of thought process and light bulb syndrome, if you like, sort of ding, oh yes, that's a good idea. That'll give us an advantage. So, you know, if somebody does something, I mean, how long are they going to be ahead for? You know, in the overall scheme of things, can Brawn stay ahead all season and win the world championship? Answer, probably not. They certainly don't think so. Sure. They think that they'll be swallowed up after 3, 4, 5 races, whatever, and so they're out to get as many points on board as possible. And, you know, if you're Williams, that's what you have to aim for. You know, you just have to, you know, if you find yourself in a position where you have a competitive car, which they have at the moment, and then if you look at what happened in Australia, Kazuki throws it at the wall and bang, go a load of points, and you can't afford to do that.
No, I'm wondering, do you think this year they may regret, certainly at the beginning of the year, having Kazuki? I mean, I know the reason for him being there, obviously, because they need some way of powering the car. But
I don't know. I don't know if it's something powering the car. I think it's the cost of the thing powering the car.
Sorry. But given, I mean, when they're running midfield and backwards, he's not such a liability and they haven't got as much to lose. Right now, he's near the front and he's a liability. They're set to lose a lot more.
I think liability is a little harsh, but no, let's just say his enthusiasm sometimes gets the better of him. But then again, last year Nico Rosberg wasn't much better. You know, so, I think in the battle of the let's destroy the front wings, I think they were pretty equal.
They got through a lot.
And also, you know, let's throw away as many points as possible. They both did it. Last year, if you took all the points that they would have scored if the drivers hadn't messed it up, Williams would actually be in a much stronger position and talk would be very different, you know, because half of Formula One is about perception, and the perception of Williams is that it's a team that's on a sort of downward slide. But, you know, if you actually analyse it, if the drivers hadn't chucked away the points last year, they would have got 20 more points. And their opposition teams would have got 20 points less.
Of course, yep.
They would have been fourth or fifth in the world championship as opposed to whatever it was they turned out, eighth or ninth, I can't remember. But, you know, it's all about perception and it's all about what actually happens as opposed to what would have happened. So I have to say that, you know, if Nico Rosberg doesn't start delivering big results this year, I would think it's about time he was thrown in the skip or sent to McLaren to be second driver.
Which is about the same thing, yeah.
Well, no, I mean, because he and Lewis Hamilton have been teammates since they were in short trousers, quite literally. They were teammates in go-karts together, and, you know, they seem to get on and blah, 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 you know. But the fact is that, you know, I think the time has come, if he can't do it after this many years, the time has come for him to be sort of shuffled off and get somebody else who might be able to.
On the driver subject, I think the first time we spoke, you were talking, I may be misquoting you, but you said you weren't exactly sold yet on Vettel. Any thoughts?
He did a pretty good job, didn't he? Yeah.
He did, but any thoughts on the final, on the very last incident that brought out the final safety car? Would you put the blame anywhere? And if so, who?
Well, it's a very interesting point, actually, because, you know, we're on the subject of honesty at the moment, apparently. This is what Formula One is famous for. you know, so we're talking about honesty. So Vettel goes in and says to the stewards, well, it's my fault. And the stewards go, well, thank you very much. We'll blame you. Then he have 10 grid place penalty. And, well, bless him. I mean, that's a sweet thing to do, saying it's all my fault. But it wasn't all his fault. And he didn't really deserve to be punished and Kubica to get absolutely nothing. I mean, the fact is, it was a racing incident. Vettel didn't want to give up the place and Kubica was being impatient. But when all is said and done, you know, he was trying to defend a place. There were only a few laps to go. Kubica was trying to get the place. He was impatient. They ended up in the same place. And neither one could really... I mean, Kubica could have given him a bit more space. And Vettel could have not been as optimistic as he was going into that corner. And the result was they both screwed up. They both lost a lot of points. Hopefully they both learned something. But to punish one and not the other, it just doesn't make any sense to me. I don't think that was a good decision. And I think it's, you know, poor old Vettel now he's going to suffer for another race, which isn't really right.
Do you not think that... how do you think his perception has changed? The perception of him has changed within the paddock for doing that? Because that's an unusual thing to do, to suddenly wander up to the stewards. And I think he walked up to Mario in the paddock afterwards and apologised. That's unusual, an unusual trait for a driver. Would that raise the respect for him or lower it?
I don't think it does either, really. I mean, we forget that he only left school last week. he's a kid,
yeah.
And he's a nice kid, and I actually don't think there's anything wrong with being honest. I think it's a good trait, and that, you know, frankly, there are very few people in Formula One who are 100% honest. And as you know, I don't think anybody has any right to sort of sit on the hill of moral indignation and have a picnic. And that goes for pretty much right through the whole sport. You know, if you go back, you can pretty much find somewhere along the way the transgressions that everybody has had. So you have to face up to the fact that it's a sport where people are wheeling and dealing and ducking and diving and cutting corners and coming up and smiling and saying, yes, of course, well, I would never do such a beastly thing like that, you know, and all this sort of rubbish that goes on. And you know, the fact is that it's a street fighting sport, and some are worse than others. But, you know, I'd call it naive on his part more than anything else. I don't think that's a bad thing necessarily. I think it's delightful to find somebody who's honest enough and say, well, I got it wrong. But unfortunately, you know, by saying he got it wrong, he got all the punishment, and that wasn't really deserved. It's an interesting parallel to the Hamilton story, you know, where we're being not telling the whole truth,
sure.
Or telling the whole truth, you get punished both ways.
You do. I hadn't thought of it like that. That's a good point. Just changing the subject slightly, what did you make of Kurz made its debut last week? Pro or anti Kurz as a result of seeing what you saw in Australia?
I think I'm always going to be pro-Kurz, because Formula One has to at least pretend to be environmentally friendly, and anything that helps the sport with that image is good. We have to be socially acceptable. You know, we can't just go around with gas-guzzling monsters with flames coming at the exhaust pipe and, you know, sort of tree-felling devices on the front. You know, we have to actually fit in with the thinking of the modern world, and the thinking of the modern world is, let's save the planet.
Do you think it improved the racing, though, from a spectator point of view or from a driver's point of view?
Improving the racing is one of these things that once the world of ground effect arrived, and Pandora's box was opened. You can't put it back. You've got to live with what you've got. Formula One used to be all about technology and who's got the latest tweak and who can find the thing that does this or that, whatever. You know, any which way of going forward. And at a point at which it stopped and it started going backwards because you had to stop them going so fast that the circuits couldn't control them. You know, we have this sort of technological development, but it has to be technological development within restrictions. That is an inevitability because we can't race. You know, if you free up the whole thing, they'd be wearing G suits and we'd be racing around the desert, and there wouldn't be any people watching because one, they'd be too fast, and two, you know, you couldn't have any people within half a mile of them because when they had an accident, you might wipe out a grandstand. You know, you can't have this sort of free kind of technology just because you'd be building spaceships flying along the ground.
Another new thing we saw this weekend was fuel loads announced after qualifying, and opinion was very split on the blog whether this was a good thing or a bad thing. What do you reckon?
I think it's great because then you have some vague understanding of what on earth's going on. I mean, particularly from a journalistic point of view, in the old pre-weight days, you had to write an article on a Saturday night, which often didn't appear till a Tuesday, at which point everyone has found out what was going to happen. So you're writing things that may happen tomorrow, which is history by the time it all appears. So it was completely mad. I think it's great. I mean, it was a bit odd because one of them was very definitely wrong on the original list, because Kazuki Nakajima weighed 12 kilos, you know. I know he's a little bloke, but he's not that little. The idea of it is terrific because then at least you have a clue as to what the strategies are. And in fact, you know, in Melbourne, they weren't that different. Pretty much the whole field had the same sort of strategy to a lesser or greater extent. It will be much more useful when you have clearly defined different strategies in some races. Well, no, we may not, you know, because these things are all scientific nowadays, and they put them all in the computers, number crunch, and then they come up with, you know, what the best race is. But you have to allow for traffic and things, and sometimes people will take risks and all the rest of it. So I think it's good to have some idea of real speed. And, you know, I think that's what it showed in Australia. It showed that the Brawns are very, very solid, and that they can take a decent amount of fuel on board.
And a couple of knocks.
Yeah, well, clearly they're well built, aren't they? They're built a bit like Ross, you know. He's known as Beefy in the Formula One world. The cars, well, no, it's a little known fact. And the cars are pretty beefy too, because as Rubens proved, you know, you can be hit by some lunatic fin.
We were wrong though about the delicateness of the front wings. We expected them all to go flying and to no one for everybody to come in on lap one and replace them all. Never happened.
Well, we had four cars come in at the end of the first lap, if I recall, and several of them were missing bits and pieces. Mind you, it was the usual cast of criminals, you know.
Yes.
The sort of blokes you'd expect coming in looking for front wings.
The kind of guy who might, I don't know, miss his pit stop, that guy.
Well, hopeless. And the sat-nav. Sat-nav is the only answer. Some teams just seem to be living in cloud cuckoo land in relation to drivers. I mean, you know, if you're going to spend all this money on a car, put someone in it who's at least interested enough to know where to park.
Mentioning no names.
So clearly not expecting great things from that team. So before we let you go, who are you expecting great things from this weekend?
Here, I haven't got a clue. The nice thing about this season is that there's a sort of element of haven't got a clue. Melbourne was absolutely haven't got a clue, apart from the fact that it was fairly clear that the Brawn was going to do well, and all that was really confirmation of what we suspected. I was surprised by how fast the Red Bulls went in Australia. You know, they probably could have had a better result than they did. The tyre management was fascinating because, you know, Kubica was going on about how he thought he could have won the race. I think that was wildly optimistic. Yep. But certainly the way they used their tyres was an interesting way of doing it. You know, some of the teams took the pain first because, you know, the softer tyre was rubbish, basically. I actually don't really understand why we have a one tyre company. And why when we go to a race, one of the tyres is rubbish and the other one's all right?
Yep.
It doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. I know these things are sort of suck it and see.
But we've done that for a couple of years and it didn't improve anything. Surely they must have seen by now.
I don't. Well, I mean, obviously the tyre things have all changed, but it seems to me having two sensible tyres or two tyres that behave slightly differently, but not, you know, sort of rubbish falling apart kind of, you know, Ferrari tire eating contest. I don't really understand that, but you know, I guess that's just sort of a few years of practice, and then they'll get it right. I think that the Brawn is a terrific package. It doesn't use a lot of tyres. The others have all got little sort of flaws here and there. Some of them are just rubbish machines that are never going to win anything. But I do think it's quite interesting. I think the BMs will do well. I think the Toyotas will be fine if they can sort of not start in the back and do silly things like that. And I think there's probably 4 or 5 teams that can win races this year. Maybe more. Obviously, it's going to depend on rates of development and all the rest of it. And the interesting thing for the first 4 races this year is, of course, that development is pretty much restricted because the cars are fundamentally in Asia and the Middle East for 5 weeks. So they're not being flown home to have total revamps. You know, bits and pieces are being sent out, hand luggage, you know. And you go to the airports, you bump into engineers, they've got massive numbers of boxes. God knows how much excess baggage they have to pay. you know, I bumped into one of the McLaren bros the other day, and he had I don't know, it was like half the factory on his trolley. It was extraordinary. And then, of course, they get out of the first corner, most of it gets broken there. You know? We'll see the same pattern in the first 4 races, I think. I don't think we'll see a huge difference there. I think we'll see differences based on temperatures and tyre, the way tyres behave with different chassis. But I think on the whole, Brawn is going to be the dominant force until we hit Europe. And I think when we get to the first European race, we're going to have a period of time when the new teams, well, I say the new teams, the diffusers, if they're allowed, which I think they will be, the diffusers have to be sort of played in, and they have to work out how they, you know, understand how they work, because you can't do the testing anymore. It's going to be a lengthier process. So I would think probably it'll be sort of Monaco time before we start seeing some of the sort of new diffusers really coming on strong. And the other thing to bear in mind is that the Brawns finished 1-2 in Australia, and it was all a bit Fred Kearney's army. You know, it was the Keystone Cops, because you've got Barrichello hitting fins, and you've got Jensen having 5 seconds extra in his pit stop, which sort of, you know, people didn't really notice that. It wasn't a sort of perfect, slick, 100% efficient race. It was, they got a 1-2 despite themselves, if you like, which shows that they've got a lot of potential there yet to be exploited. So, and I think that's true of several teams. I think that's why we've got, and that's one of the joys of it, you know. I think it's exciting because we do have the potential for lots of different winners, and I'd much prefer that situation than have a straight, you know, a straight McLaren Ferrari fight is fine, but it's nice to have 4 or 5 teams in it, and it you know, I think that helps the numbers of people who watch, just because, you know, who knows who's going to win this weekend. Must watch to find out if that strange schoolboy again, you know, or whatever. It people like new winners, people like different winners.
So what does, it's Friday where you are. We're
I have no idea. I have no idea what day of the week it is. Must be Friday because cars are making noises.
We're planning to stay up and follow Free Practice 1 and 2. What does the rest of your day have in store?
Well, I'm going to have breakfast, and then I shall head off to the racetrack, and they'll do their practicing, and it'll be a normal Friday, I think. We'll see what happens. I hope that all the political shenanigans will be over, and we can get on with what we do, which is motor racing. And there is an argument that controversy is good because it gets more space in the papers and it gets on the news and all these things, and therefore, you know, people watch it more. And there's a certain element of truth in that. But at the same time, you have to keep the credibility of the sport, because if you have too many outrages and scandals and revamps 5 days after the event and all this sort of stuff, it gives the sport a very shonky image. I think the best race for Formula One was Brazil last year, where it was just down to, you know, sportsmanship and a bit of luck and a bit of weather and just terrific drivers going up against each other, and, you know, chariot racing. It was Ben-Hur without the horses, you know. And that's what we want. That's what we should aspire to, and not all the sort of rubbish that comes with it. But that's just sort of part of the show, really, I suppose. But we try to manage it in a better fashion. It would be good.
Well, that sounds like a very good place to leave it. Enjoy your day today. We're very jealous that you're out there.
We are. thank you for spending your morning with us, Joe. Very much appreciated. And will we see you again before, where are we next? China?
No idea. Oh, China, that's right. Yeah. my next exciting adventure is the Chinese embassy in Paris to get my visa sorted out. And then, yes, I shall be off to Shanghai and whenever that is, 2 weeks' time, yep. I think. And I have a vague suspicion, time zones allowing, we'll probably be able to chat again.
You're a legend. Thank you very much. Cheers, Joe.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.